We did discuss the wall. We didn't discuss payment of the wall.
What? Cowardly Donald. Chicken Don.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake, up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ, on the Central Coast, 106.7 FM KSO in Cottage Grove, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 93 FM WLRI, in Maui, Hawaii, 88.5 FM KAKU. Stay safe out there in Maui. Columbus, Ohio's WGRN 94.1 FM, Palinville, New York's WLPP on 102.9 FM, and AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. And yep, coast to coast and around the globe, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com. I hear she's doing well. Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, and Radio Sputnik, blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today, for joining me and Desi Doyen, who is here as ever. How are
you,
Desi Doyen?
I am good. I am here.
I'm glad you are here. And not in Mexico with Donald Trump today. He has just finished his meeting with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto and answered a few questions from the press afterwards, in which it became clear that, he said they discussed the wall that Donald Trump has promised endlessly he will build across the southern border of the United States and make Mexico pay for it. They discussed that wall, but Trump says he didn't talk to the president about who is going to pay for it. So he appears to have chickened out on that regard. And a lot of folks are now talking about that in the minutes since that very short press conference wrapped up. Greg Sargent at The Washington Post tweets that before the press conference was done, he tweeted, "If Trump does not urinate or vomit on Peña Nieto, he will have exceeded expectations and proven how presidential he is." And if you look at what the media is tweeting and writing about today, that is, in fact, the case. He has defied expectations by looking like a president and by not, you know, passing out, not having his head fall off. So the phrase comes to mind from the George W. Bush era, the soft bigotry of low expectations. I think those were in play in Mexico City today. Anyway, everyone else will talk about that, so we don't need to, happily. President Obama, as we go to air, he is on his way towards the G20 summit in China. He'll be making stops on the way in Tahoe, Nevada, in Hawaii, and at the Midway Atoll. He's scheduled to give speeches on climate change on the route and to dedicate a new protected national marine reserve in Hawaii, which will be the world's largest. That trip, and specifically the speech in Hawaii, now looks like it will be coinciding, at least to some respect, with a hurricane that is quickly heading towards the Hawaiian Islands today, with a second one waiting in line behind it, Desi Doyen.
Yes.
A bit of irony there, I suppose. Climate change speeches perhaps forestalled by hurricanes. But we will see. That irony is somewhat echoed by a federal offshore oil lease auction that we've been talking about over the past few days down in the Gulf of Mexico. That took place last week in Louisiana on the same day that the that the president toured flood disaster sites down in Baton Rouge, where an historic deluge, including 2 feet of rain falling in some areas over just 4 hours, swamped the region there, led to the deaths of 13 people and damaged some 60,000 homes. Well, with all of that, several environmentalist groups are now suing the Obama administration to try and force them to issue a moratorium on the further leasing of federal lands and waters for the production of oil and gas, similar to the moratorium that the Obama administration has already placed on further coal leases on federal lands. That was done. Was that earlier this year?
Yeah, that was just a couple of months ago, because their inspector general of the Interior Department found evidence that had been exposed by investigative journalists by like ProPublica about how coal companies are shorting the American public. Not only is the Bureau of Land Management leasing the lands of public lands for coal mining at way below market rates, but there was also this little trick that coal companies would put into place where they would sell it to themselves so they wouldn't have to pay the high royalties, and then ship it out and sell it to somebody else, paying the much getting the much higher price without paying royalties on it.
It's also killing the planet.
And
so
that
there's
too.
That. So that's what the Obama administration did when it came to coal, but not so for oil and gas. And that's why these groups are suing. We will speak shortly to a representative from one of those groups who is suing the Obama administration's Bureau of Land Management to try and force them to keep it in the ground. That is ahead. Also, a number of follow-up developments today, if time allows, on a number of stories that we've been reporting on and following closely of late here on the broadcast over the past several days. So that's also ahead. And now some breaking news as we go to air. The Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has now declined to reinstate sweeping North Carolina voting restrictions. This is a huge victory for voting rights. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, as we've been discussing, struck down this massive voter suppression law that Republicans in North Carolina had passed, restricting all kinds of elements, early voting, early registration, photo ID, putting in place photo ID restrictions, and much more. All of that was struck down by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, finding that those restrictions had purposely, quote, targeted African Americans with nearly surgical precision. Of course, North Carolina went to the Supreme Court to try and roll back that injunction, try at least to get a stay on that injunction, claiming that, oh, we can't change the law this close to the election, even though they had previously told the Fourth Circuit Court that, yes, they could deal with any decision that the Fourth Circuit had made as long as it came out before the end of July, which this decision had. So now the Supreme Court is declining to put a stay on that injunction. In fact, they have tied 4-4. It's a deadlock, which means the lower court ruling stands. The lower court ruling in this case, which had struck down those unbelievably restrictive laws, the worst voter suppression laws since the Jim Crow era. Of course, they probably wouldn't have tied had Antonin Scalia still been alive. In this case, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Kennedy, Justice Alito, and Justice Thomas, they would have all granted the stay. But the four liberal appointees on the court said they would not. That meant there's a tie, and a tie goes to the lower court. So it would have been 5-4. They probably would have got the stay on that, and we would have seen a lot of voting restrictions in North Carolina had Antonin Scalia still been alive. So there is that. Now the fight in North Carolina will go to a county-by-county fight over early voting. We've been reporting on that. We will continue to keep our eyes on that. Meantime, speaking of elections, it was primary day on Tuesday in both Florida and Arizona. Let's hit some of these results very quickly. First, here in Florida, Republican Senator Marco Rubio will face off against Democratic Congressman Patrick Murphy in the U.S. Senate race in Florida this November. Marco Rubio easily won his primary on Tuesday in the Sunshine State. He got nearly 72% of the vote in his bid for the Republican nomination, seeking a second term. That after he broke his pledge to not run for re-election after he was trounced in his presidential bid, where he had promised for months and months he would not be running again for the Senate. Well, not so much. I guess he is running after all, and he won his race. Of course, he lost the state of Florida during the presidential primary itself to Donald Trump. In this case, he defeated a real estate developer who had served as a surrogate for Trump during the primaries, where Trump had called him, you'll recall, Little Marco, called him a lightweight. Rubio called Trump a con man, only to come out in support of Trump now that the con man is the GOP's presidential nominee. Meanwhile, former Republican turned very corporatist Democrat Patrick Murphy soundly defeated his top competitor, progressive firebrand Congressman Alan Grayson. So Murphy wins the Democratic nomination in the U.S. Senate race. Murphy had took nearly 60% of the vote. He'll now face Rubio on November 8th in a race, a key race, that will help decide which party controls the U.S. Senate next year. Polls currently show Rubio with a narrow lead over Murphy in that race, with about 70 days to go. Speaking of establishment Democrats, one of the most hotly contested and closely watched Democratic U.S. House primaries in Florida on Tuesday was between Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz and her Bernie Sanders-endorsed challenger, Tim Canova. Wasserman Schultz, of course, you'll recall, was forced to step down from her role as DNC chair on the eve of the Democratic National Convention in July in the wake of the DNC email hacks, confirming that the party's establishment had supported, or at least were showing support for Hillary Clinton over Sanders in the presidential primary. Results show the six-term Congresswoman defeating Canova by some 14 points, 57 to 43 on Tuesday. Wasserman Schultz is expected to coast to re-election at this point in the very Democratic-leaning Florida district that she serves. She described the victory as incredibly sweet and satisfying. When asked on Tuesday night by local media whether he planned to concede and endorse the controversial congresswoman and the longtime Clinton supporter, Tim Canova told reporters, quote, I'll concede that Debbie Wasserman Schultz is a corporate stooge. How's that?
Wow. Meow.
Yep. There you go. That's what happened in some of the key races in any event in Florida. Meanwhile, over in Arizona, Arizona's U.S. Senator and, yes, Donald Trump supporter, whether he'll likes to admit it or not, John McCain, seeking his sixth six-year term as a U.S. senator, defeated his main populist nativist Republican primary challenger, former state senator Kelly Ward, a true Trump believer. The 2008 Republican presidential nominee who gave the world Sarah Palin and the rest of the Tea Party slash Freedom Caucus slash alt-right faction that the nation is still contending with. And most notably, I guess, in the candidacy of Donald Trump, who, by the way, has suggested that McCain is not a war hero because he was captured in Vietnam. He once called him a dummy. But nonetheless, John McCain is still supporting Donald Trump. In any event, McCain is now thought to be facing his toughest re-election battle to date. On Tuesday night, the 80-year-old McCain won just under 52% of the vote in his primary race in Arizona, according to election night results, in what could be seen as a defeat for Donald Trump, since Ward, his main opponent there, she was a huge supporter. And even as McCain cowed to, you know, support the GOP nominee, largely for personal political convenience, in any event, Ward did not take her loss well either. She said, she told reporters last night, after refusing to debate while running a slash and burn campaign devoid of actual ideas, I hope the senator can rest comfortably with his conscience as he continues to lecture others about civility. Kelly Ward added, the Republican Party cannot win as a national party if we keep nominating unprincipled career politicians whose only objective is perpetual re-election. So a lot of sore losers, it seems, on Tuesday on both the Democratic and the Republican side. John McCain will face off against Democratic U.S. House Rep. Ann Kirkpatrick. She ran unopposed. But for a write-in opponent, I believe. Otherwise, she ran unopposed for the Democratic Party nomination. Some other races very quickly of note. Joe Arpaio, the controversial Maricopa County sheriff and 84-year-old Trump supporter. He wins his primary for a seventh term in Maricopa County, Arizona, vanquishing three other Republican opponents to win that primary. And for those who are still angry at the longtime Republican county recorder in Maricopa County. You're looking surprised already, Desi Doyen?
No, I'm waiting with bated breath.
Yes, that's right. She is, of course, that would be Helen Purcell. She is the county's chief election official in Phoenix, Arizona, Maricopa County, where polling sites during the presidential primary this year were radically reduced. She radically reduced them from 200 back in 2012 to just about 60 poll sites in Maricopa in Phoenix this year. Maybe some good news for you people who don't care for Helen Purcell. Bernie, I know a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters had blamed Purcell for those problems that, you know, many voters had trying to cast a vote in that primary election earlier this year. There were long lines all over the city because of what Purcell did. Many of the polling places in less affluent areas were shut down in those minority areas thanks to her scheme. Now, her scheme, by the way, was to create voting centers where anybody could vote as opposed to precinct-based voting. And that's why, at least ostensibly, she had reduced the number of poll sites, because in theory, you don't need 200 polls if you can vote at any of them, if you don't have to go to your specific precinct. That was her argument in any event. It probably would have been stopped had the Voting Rights Act not been gutted by the Supreme Court. In any event, she was a Republican, which I got to remind a lot of the Bernie Sanders people who claim that she was, you know, trying, she was in the bag for Hillary. Helen Purcell is a Republican. And both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have sued her for that action. In any event, with all of that in mind, Purcell herself was on the ballot on Tuesday night. And now she appears to be in the fight of her life right now as we go to air, with 99% of the precincts reporting, according to the Maricopa elections site run by Purcell herself. Helen Purcell is now said to be losing her to her Republican challenger in this race, her Republican challenger, Erin Flannery, by just 339 votes.
Wow.
That out of 26,000 votes so far counted or tallied by their electronic computers out there in Maricopa, 339 vote margin. That is a difference of 0.14%. Now, when I went to bed last night, Purcell was winning, by the way, by 116 votes. So now that result has currently flipped. There are still provisional ballots to be counted and canvassing to be done. So, you know, once again, it's going to be close no matter what. So by way of a reminder, voting matters. Every single vote counts, or at least it's supposed to. And it actually might in this case in Maricopa County. Purcell, by the way, has been the county recorder in Maricopa since 1988, serving seven terms. So about 30 years in that role, at least until now, maybe, perhaps, we will see. So this is big if the results hold throughout the canvassing, et cetera. We're at the end of the primary cycle, almost. There are still some states' primaries to come in Massachusetts, New York, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Delaware in early September. Then that is it until general presidential election day on November 8th. What could possibly go wrong? We'll take a quick break, and we are back with much more Bradcast right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. All right, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with you here. Last week in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, President Obama promised long-term aid to victims of the extraordinary flooding down there. Some 2 feet of rain fell in just 2 days in some parts of the state. And while Obama has been a champion in a number of respects in the fight against global warming, he failed to mention climate change at all in his remarks after that devastating historic disaster in Louisiana, which resulted in some 13 deaths and more than 60,000 flooded homes. Ironically, not long after his remarks there, I think on the same day, a federal auction was held for new offshore oil leases. The bad news, 23 million acres of the Gulf of Mexico were put up for sale in that lease sale. The good news, sort of, apparently the auction was a bit of a dud. As our own Desi Doyen reported last week, just 138,000 acres were sold. I guess that's a dud, according to the Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, at least out of the millions of acres that were for sale. That was apparently the lowest amount ever at a drilling rights auction, according to The Hill. Still, the sale and Obama's very presence in Louisiana last week seems to present a very stark contrast between rhetoric and action at times by the administration over the past 8 years. Obama helped broker the landmark Paris Climate Agreement last year, has established the landmark Clean Power Plan, requiring fairly drastic reductions in greenhouse gas emissions from states. And while the Interior Department has announced a moratorium on new coal leases on federal lands, they have not done the same for new oil and gas leases, which has rankled a number of environmentalists. Last week, according to Rebecca Moss at the New Mexican, a Santa Fe-based environmental group filed a federal lawsuit against the Obama administration seeking a moratorium on all oil and gas lease sales on public lands until the completion of an analysis showing how drilling impacts climate change. Wild Earth Guardians and Washington, D.C.-based Physicians for Social Responsibility claim in the suit that nearly 400 drilling leases were sold across 380,000 acres of public land in Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming without any analysis of the environmental or public health effects. Since President Barack Obama took office in 2008, the suit notes, more than 10 million acres have been leased for oil and gas drilling, which the group says flies in the face of the administration's commitment to reducing carbon emissions. Quote, "We cannot continue to blindly commit our public lands to oil and gas exploitation and have a shot at meeting the administration's climate goals," says Kyle Tisdell, an attorney from the Western Environmental Law Center in Denver, who is representing the plaintiffs in this suit. "The Interior Department is in climate denial," added Samantha Ruskavage Bars, a staff attorney for Wildlife Guardians. Joining us now to discuss that denial and their denial by the Barack Obama administration, to discuss that denial and their lawsuit is Jeremy Nichols. He's the director of the Climate Energy and the Climate and Energy Program at Wild Earth Guardians, one of the plaintiffs here. They are a grassroots organization working through the court system to fight fossil fuel development, promote clean energy, and develop innovative strategies to safeguard the climate and the American West. He's also the founder of the nonprofit Rocky Mountain Clean Air Action, and he joins us today from Golden, Colorado. Jeremy Nichols, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Thanks, Brad.
All right. In your there's some kind of some amazing stuff here, it seems to me, and some amazing contrasts that need to be sorted out. Contracts too, I guess. In your press release, you state that the administration, since taking office, has sold some 10 million acres of public land rights to the oil and gas industry, often for as little as $2 an acre. And that's an area 50% larger than Yellowstone, Everglades, Grand Canyon, Olympic, Yosemite, and Great Smoky Mountains National Parks combined. Wow. And nonetheless, you write, the administration refuses to disclose the impacts of this oil and gas leasing on our climate. So what exactly are you seeking in this suit? The disclosure of the environmental impact studies, if they even exist here for these lands, or to simply put a moratorium on all such leases, as we've seen the administration do at least when it comes to coal mining?
Yeah, well, what we're seeing here is a pattern and practice of the administration continuing to hand over the rights to our public lands to the oil and gas industry. And it literally is handing over the rights. They are, by leasing these lands, they basically convert them to the ownership of the industry, and industry can hang on to these lands for as long as they want and continue to develop them and pump oil and gas out of the ground. It really is what we would call an irreversible commitment of public resources here. And it's happened. It's continued to happen time and time again over the years, even though we know today, and have known for some time, that when we are facilitating more oil and gas production, we are in essence condoning the release of a lot more carbon into our atmosphere. And in this moment in time, pumping more carbon into the atmosphere is the last thing that this administration and we as the American public should be condoning. The problem here has been the administration has a very serious blind spot. Certainly they have acknowledged that in other aspects of fossil fuel management that there needs to be some restraint right now. With the oil and gas program, and particularly here on the ground in the western United States, there's absolutely no restraint. Industry demands a lease, and the U.S. Department of the Interior turns around and sells it to them. It's almost as if the administration is completely beholden to the oil and gas industry when it comes to this program. And given that we are in a moment of time when we need an all-hands-on-deck approach to combating climate change, including not only addressing smokestacks and tailpipes, but also addressing the production of fossil fuels, we feel that it's high time for this administration to apply the same scrutiny to the oil and gas program that it has applied to coal-fired power plants, its coal mining program, and other aspects of our fossil fuel consumption.
So is that, once again, I guess it brings me back to that same question. Are you trying to, the lawsuit itself, does it seek the disclosure of environmental impact studies, or is it just trying to shut down, for shutting down these land leases, or I guess both, shutting it down until the environmental impact studies are released? And by the way, do we even know if those environmental impact studies actually exist from the administration?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I think the end game is we would prefer not to see fossil fuels produced. It just seems like no matter how you slice them, they are dirty. They negatively affect our health, our water, our air. But that's a long-term proposition here. We do not have the solutions in place to simply say tomorrow we are going to stop producing oil and stop producing natural gas. We need to create space for solutions to be developed and to take hold to help our nation and our world be able to transition from these fossil fuels. The biggest step forward that we can take in that direction is to, in the near term, at least say we're going to stop handing over the rights to our public lands to the oil and gas industry. And we're at a moment in time where, right now, of the oil and gas leases that exist in the United States, the publicly owned oil and gas leases, only 40% of them right now are actually producing oil and gas. So there's 60% of all the leases that are out there. Industry is just sitting on them. They're not using them. They're not producing oil and gas. Put another way, we are not even dependent on those leases. We feel like industry has already been leased enough of our public land to be able to continue to produce oil and gas and to keep our nation fueled and secure as we develop the solutions. And so it's actually a critical moment that we're seeing, both in terms of climate progress, awareness over the impacts of fossil fuel production, and just the state of the oil and gas industry in this nation. You'll probably know oil and gas prices are very low right now. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of production going on in the world. We're at this beautiful moment where we can say, hey, it's time for a timeout. Let's take that timeout and let's develop a plan for the best path forward here. Our hope is it does lead to a future where we don't have to depend on oil and gas, but obviously there are a lot of steps we need to take to get there, and we want to be able to give the public, to give experts, to give policymakers and officials the opportunity to to make suggestions on that path forward. And that's this environmental review that we're calling for.
Yeah.
It's not so much about demanding an analysis as it is about opening up a public discourse, a public dialogue that has yet to happen around how we manage oil and gas.
Now, at the same time, speaking of the oil and gas industry, the Western Energy Alliance, that's a fossil fuel trade group, they have filed a complaint against the U.S. Department of the Interior, claiming that actions that deterring oil and gas lease sales violates the Mineral Leasing Act, which requires the government to make minerals on federal lands available to the public. So their suit is actually sort of the opposite. They're saying the administration is not leasing enough. They say that, quote, this is according to Rebecca Moss again at the New Mexican, through protests and petitions, the Keep It in the Ground movement is trying to coerce the Bureau of Land Management into violating the law by stopping all leasing on federal lands. That's according to Kathleen Sagema, the vice president of Western Energy Alliance, in a statement. They go on to say that without quarterly lease sales, the federal government, states, and taxpayers lose out on valuable revenue. So I know you're not an attorney here, I don't think, Jeremy Nichols, but does the federal requirement to hold these lease sales somehow tie the Obama administration's hands, at least until Congress changes the laws in this way? Is that a potential explanation for the Obama administration continuing to lease these lands, as far as you know?
Well, first thing, in response to the Western Energy Alliance's lawsuit, I mean, it really is a shocking filing on their end. I mean, they're basically saying that even though they've gotten everything they want on our public lands, 10 million acres of our public land since President Obama has taken office, that it's not enough for them. That even though the Bureau of Land Management within the Department of the Interior continues to lease oil and gas on almost a quarterly basis, that's not enough for the oil and gas industry. And I think that there exposes the predicament that we're in right now, where we have an oil and gas industry that is so greedy and so, has literally put the American public not only in the back seat but in the trunk when it comes to managing our publicly owned oil and gas. But, you know, we really need some bold action here, and we need the Bureau of Land Management and the Interior Department to step up. And we do believe that there is discretion under the existing laws to say, you know what, it's time for a timeout. This crisis has boiled over, and we need to come up with real effective solutions. Now, if the Western Energy Alliance is right, that effectively, if the industry demands an oil and gas lease, that our federal government has no choice but to sell them that oil and gas lease, then that to us would just kick the crisis up to an extreme level. Our public resources, we don't believe Congress, first and foremost, created legislation that mandated our federal government to appease the oil and gas industry's interests in such an extreme way. But if that is the case, then I would hope that people in Congress, you know, as frustrating as they may be, would realize that it is not to the public's benefit to simply manage our oil and gas resources according to the whims of the oil and gas industry's greed. And so, it'll be an interesting test case.
Yeah.
We believe they're wrong, but if they're right, I think it's just going to fuel the move to reform the way our oil and gas is managed.
Well, yeah, and of course, good luck waiting for Congress to take action on that. I guess a lot depends. Underscores once again that a lot depends on what happens this November, if Democrats can take back the Senate and maybe even the House. But, you know, when Democrats controlled the Senate back in, what was it, 2009, and they could have passed something like this, Democrats passed a cap and trade bill in the House, but they could not get one passed in the Senate. And it was Democrats included who were, holdouts there. So a lot of Democrats are beholden to that oil and gas industry. President Obama has cited, Jeremy, the impact of the climate on his decision concerning the Keystone XL pipeline when he finally rejected that Canadian tar sands company TransCanada's plan to build that massive pipeline from Alberta down to the Gulf of Mexico. Now, as I noted at the top of the show, he's also been a champion at times for the environment, to be fair. And, he's taken a lot of action against climate change. So how does Wild Earth Guardians, your group, explain that apparent blind spot that you cited in some aspects of the administration's environmental policy. Are they beholden to gas, oil and gas industries as you see it? Or are they just following the law? Or do they just not understand the danger? I mean, there seems to be some circles here that are very difficult to square, as they say, in the policies.
Right. No, that's you're exactly right. And I think, here's the thing. I think if you ask Americans, let's say you ask every American, have you ever heard of the federal oil and gas program? And are you aware that your Western public lands are regularly auctioned off to the oil and gas industry? I would venture to guess that probably three quarters, if not more, way more, would say that they don't know that and they weren't aware. And so I think part of this is helping to build a level of awareness that can foster the effective action that we're looking for. And I'll give President Obama a lot of credit. He has definitely acknowledged the importance of addressing climate change and in doing something about it. And so we feel like, though, our challenge is to help to define and illuminate the imperative. I'll be honest, I think he probably doesn't understand the impacts of the federal oil and gas program to our climate. And our lawsuit is one very powerful vehicle for helping to open his eyes and to open his eyes to understanding that he is in control of these this agency, the Interior Department, that is wielding a tremendous amount of influence over our nation's climate legacy. We really want to reach the president on this. Certainly the agencies, the Bureau of Land Management in particular, continues to lease oil and gas. And I think that's a function of a long ingrained culture. That's been their business for many years, selling off the public's oil and gas to help generate revenue. Well, now we realize that climate is exacting a terrible toll on our country. I mean, the costs continue to mount. You mentioned the floods in Louisiana, directly a result of our changing climate. Don't tell me that bringing money in for oil and gas is more important than trying to prevent the costs of another Louisiana flood. Now, we're in a moment in time where we really do see that the costs of continuing to extract oil and gas are not worth it for our nation. And we are trying to help our president understand that so he can continue to take bold and decisive action for our climate and for our future.
I'm speaking with Jeremy Nichols, the director of the Climate and Energy Program of Wild Earth Guardians. They are suing the Obama administration to force them to disclose climate impact studies, or in lieu of that, put a moratorium on the sale of oil and gas leases on federal lands around the country, as they have done with coal leases, but not oil and gas for some reason. I want to hit something, Jeremy, that you mentioned earlier, that these companies, that once they obtain access to this federal land, they retain the rights, essentially, is it forever? What are the requirements of these types of leases? How long do they get to hold on to them? You suggest they just sort of buy it up and then sit on it for decades? Is there no limit to how long they can control that land and how long it will be before the public can take it back from them, particularly if they're not going to be exploiting it for oil and gas?
Yeah, so here's the basic rule. Once a company gets an oil and gas lease, if they punch a well into the ground on that lease, then they can hang on to that lease for as long as they want, called putting a lease in production. And so long as a lease is in production, doesn't necessarily have to be producing constantly, but as long as that's the case, then a company can hang on to a lease for as long as it wants.
Wow.
Now, there are various exemptions, too. If a company doesn't put a lease in production, the Interior Department oftentimes cuts industry a break and says, well, go ahead and hang on to it for a little longer until you decide you're ready to punch a hole in the ground and put a well in. And we find that too often the Interior Department is allows industry to hang on to these leases even beyond when they should be put back into the public's hands. And it's a chronic problem that some groups have found, several million acres of Western public lands are in kind of this limbo where they're not producing, but leases should be canceled, but they haven't been. And that's part of the problem with this program, is it's a veritable black box. And at the end of the day, it seems only to serve the oil and gas industry and not the American public. And so hopefully with this lawsuit and with continued public pressure, hopefully we're on track to change that.
Well, doesn't it serve the public, Jeremy, in that right now, at least, we need energy. We need energy. We rely on oil and natural gas. The Obama administration has described natural gas as a bridge fuel to get us off of oil and coal, which are arguably much dirtier. I know the oil companies and the coal companies, they like to say that people like you, Jeremy, are condemning us to live in darkness. In a cave, yeah, back to the Stone Age. What do you say to that? And what do you say, frankly, to people who would tend to be on your side, progressives and so forth, who say, as Hillary Clinton has over the years, that natural gas is a bridge fuel. We need to get off of gas and coal. So I'm sorry, oil and coal. So we need to go to natural gas to be able to stay out of those dark caves entirely.
Well, first off, on the subject of natural gas, I think, the statement of it being a bridge fuel, I think it was made many years ago in haste. It was politically expedient. Over the years, we have gained a lot more knowledge about the true cost of natural gas development, both in terms of methane leaks, the scale of leaking pipelines, and what that is doing for our climate. Methane, of course, is, could be up to 80 times more powerful than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. We're also realizing that the shift to natural gas is still creating a lot of carbon emissions. Believe it or not, natural gas is still a fossil fuel, and when burned, it does produce carbon. And even though it may be cleaner than coal, it's simply replacing coal with gas is not bringing emissions down to a safe level. And so that is not a responsible path forward to take. I think what we're looking at are the totality of costs associated with oil and gas development. We lose our public land. Increasingly, our wildlife, Western wildlife populations are losing habitat, and their populations are declining in the face of oil and gas development. Our water is being contaminated. Our air is being filled with pollution. I challenge anybody to try to make the case that somehow it is healthy and appropriate for us to continue to rely on fossil fuels. Nevertheless, we are dependent on them right now, and I will fully acknowledge that. And I think it speaks to this need to start to, like I said earlier, take the first steps toward weaning our nation away from fossil fuels. And we can do that by, first and foremost, ending the practice of leasing. And as I said, industry already, 40% of its leases they're producing on. The other 60% they're not even producing on. They have enough leases to continue to provide oil and gas for our nation in the near future. I think in the long term, however, we need to come up with a plan that takes those leases from the oil and gas industry, puts them back in the public's hands, and that helps to foment a future where we are fueled by something other than fossil fuels. I understand that solutions haven't fully taken hold yet, but we feel like by at least starting to say no and starting to say keep it in the ground, we will create the space for innovation to really get kicked into high gear.
And I think it's important to note that your lawsuit was filed along with Physicians for Social Responsibility, citing the medical concerns of these continuing practices. On that point, Green Party presidential nominee Dr. Jill Stein has called for climate action far beyond, really, what Hillary Clinton has called for. Never mind Donald Trump, who's, calling for, rolling back all regulations, getting rid of all regulations, essentially, against the fossil fuel industry, called climate change a hoax. But Stein's program goes beyond what Hillary Clinton has called for. And as a doctor, she has said, Jill Stein has said that much of the program can be paid for by cost savings due to lower medical costs, et cetera, associated with the fossil fuels and the healthier society, she argues, we would have if we got rid of them. Now, her numbers, I think, may be questionable as far as what health savings will pay for and will not pay for. But does your organization have a position on the presidential candidates and on their positions on these various issues?
Well, we certainly appreciate bold vision, and I think that if we're going to solve these big problems, we need to bring bold vision. Certainly, we need pragmatic solutions. But if we aren't clear on where we're going ultimately, then I don't think we're going to get the right policies in place. Certainly focusing on the health savings is important. Also, keeping carbon in the ground, saves us climate costs. There is money to be had by keeping carbon in the ground right now. And there's also opportunities to perhaps ensure that the fossil fuel industry, as they continue to produce, pays their fair share. Should we charge them more for the privilege of producing our oil and gas and direct that money toward economic transition? We're seeing immense potential around coal issues. Those policies hold a lot of promise, and I think the reality is we can't keep mining coal, so let's at least get what we need from the industry at this time, and as we work to put them out of business. I think a similar concept can be put in place for oil and gas. As you said, we're selling leases right now for $2 an acre. If we sold them for $4 an acre, would that put the oil and gas industry out of business? I doubt it, but it would yield an extra $2 on top of the $2 already that we're making. That is money that we can direct toward transition and toward innovation.
And I was going to say, I'm trying to sort of press you here. I've got just a minute or two. I'm trying to press you here. A lot of people have said, well, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, they're the same. The only option is a Jill Stein. And obviously there is a question whether a Jill Stein can even, come close to being elected across the country. And so if we look at a binary choice then between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, where Hillary Clinton is going to continue many of the same policies, I suspect, as the Obama administration, I know that would be a concern to you. But if you look at those two, is there any thoughts you have that your group has on that binary choice that many Americans may see themselves facing on this issue that is so important?
Yeah, it's been uncomfortable just because, we're a 501c3 and a lot of Guardians doesn't take positions on candidates. I mean, certainly Trump's position on our issues we're very frightful of. Mm-hmm. And certainly Hillary Clinton, we do worry that many of the policies that are in place now that we feel have not been as effective as they could be will be continued. I think no matter what happens, we're going to continue to be pushing for the fullest vision. And, no matter who is elected, I think we're going to have to remain vigilant. The fossil fuel industry wields a tremendous amount of power, and even the most progressive candidates, they're going to need a push every now and then.
Yes.
We have a major challenge ahead of us.
Keep up the good push, Jeremy. It is much needed. All of this coming on the same week, by the way, as the National Park Service turns 100. There have been celebrations and many huzzas to the service and the nation's spectacular national park system's commitment to protecting public lands. We've heard that from the Obama administration, from Hillary Clinton, and yet it seems almost impossible to square this circle with the continuing turning over of federal lands to these oil and gas companies. So, Jeremy, thank you and your group for continuing to push. Good luck with this lawsuit. Hope you'll stay in touch as the suit moves forward. We'd love to have you back to talk about the progress as it does.
It'd be great to be back, Matt. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jeremy. Jeremy Nichols, Director of the Climate and Energy Program at Wild Earth Guardians. You can get more information on the lawsuit and on their good work at wildearthguardians.org. You can also follow them on the Twitters at Climate West and at Our Carbon, O-U-R Carbon. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, Matt.
All right, a quick break, and we're back with more broadcast. A couple of updates, a number of updates on some stories we have been covering on this program lately. That and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Yes, if you're Maine Governor Paul LePage, it does make you crazy. If you missed our show yesterday, we went we told the ballad of Paul LePage. You can download the entire program at bradblog.com. This guy is just melting down, really. And he left. We went into great detail yesterday on all of this. He left this profane, obscene message for a Democratic state lawmaker, threatening to come and get him, calling him all kinds of names that we had to bleep out like crazy. But, you know, Paul LePage has been kind of crazy for quite some time, which is why we've been covering him year after year after year, and which is why it is so amazing that the state of Maine reelected him. Well, now he seems to be having a meltdown after leaving this voicemail for this Democratic legislator, after telling the media there that he wishes it was, what was it, 1855, so he could have a duel with him.
And shoot him between the eyes.
And shoot him between the eyes, saying that he is at war, and basically blaming black people for the drug epidemic up in Maine amongst Maine's white people. In any event, Republican lawmakers up there sort of had an intervention with this guy to try to talk him down earlier this week. They said that he's going to be talking to people to seek help. Well, and in the meantime, Paul LePage was talking about maybe he was going to resign. Well, now it looks like he's claiming he is not going to resign. However, he has vowed to never speak to the media again. Seriously. According to TPM, Maine Governor Paul LePage said on Wednesday that he has no plans to resign after a week full of high-profile embarrassments. But he does intend to seek, quote, spiritual guidance, unquote. He said, I will not resign. He's what he told reporters in his office after a meeting with the Maine State Rep Drew Gattine, the guy who he had left a message threatening on his voicemail, calling him all sorts of names that I cannot repeat here. So he met with him. And then according to the Boston Globe, LePage also said that he would seek spiritual guidance with his family, but he had no plans to seek, quote, professional help. So
that's too bad.
Yeah, it is actually is kind of too bad because he could use it. He's a far right, you know, alt-right, big supporter of Donald Trump. He's you know, been meeting with these folks, these Tea Party folks, for years, coming up with these insane conspiracy theories.
He seems ill-equipped to handle the pressures of the job.
And
now
he's, yeah. So he's going to get spiritual guidance, but not professional help. And then he went on to vow that, quote, he will no longer speak to the press ever again after today, saying that he was tired of being caught in, quote, gotcha moments by the media. He said, I'm serious. Everything will be put in writing. I'm tired of being caught in the gotcha moments. So there you go. That's where Paul LePage is. On Tuesday, he had gone so far as to say he might not be able to finish his second term as governor. He said, I think some things I've been asked to do are beyond my ability. I'm not going to say that I'm going to finish it, the term. I'm not going to say that I'm not saying that I'm going to finish it. I don't know what the hell he was saying, actually. I don't think anybody does. But after he said that, he went on to say that rumors of his possible resignation are, quote, greatly exaggerated. Well, we will see how it goes after he gets a bit of spiritual guidance, but not professional help. In another quick follow-up here, we've got today, we had been reporting a few days ago on Stephen Bannon, the CEO, the recently appointed CEO of the Donald Trump campaign, who had been registered to vote in the state of Florida in Miami-Dade County, where he did not actually live. He was registered to vote at what is now a vacant house. It was the house of his former wife, where he was registered, even though he apparently did not live in Florida, which would be a violation of the law, which would be a third-degree felony in Florida. And just the latest example of voter registration fraud by top high-level Republicans. This is a guy who used to head the Breitbart News service. Breitbart News is out there along with the Republicans claiming that we need all of these voting restrictions because Democrats are carrying out so much voter fraud. And yet they are the ones caught doing it time and time again themselves. As we have been discussing over the past week, Mitt Romney did the same thing, registered to vote in his son's unfinished basement in January of 2010, even though he did not live in the state of Massachusetts, where his son lived at the time. He had houses in New Hampshire and California, but not in Massachusetts. Yet Mitt Romney had registered to vote there. That would also be illegal. And Ann Coulter famously committed voter registration fraud and voter fraud, by the way, in the state of Florida when she registered at a house where she did not live. So Republicans do this all the time. The list goes on and on and on. We've been covering it for years, even while they're claiming that Democrats are out there doing the same thing. In any event, now Steve Bannon is apparently being investigated by state's attorneys in Florida's Miami-Dade County. They are reportedly looking into his voter records as Donald Trump's campaign chief. This is NBC News reporting that his voting history in the state of Florida has been turned over by election officials in the area. Rosie Pastrana, executive assistant to the county's election supervisor, said that I know that there is an investigation, but I know very little about it. They requested voter records for him, which is why I know there is an investigation ongoing. State Attorney Ed Griffith said he couldn't comment except to say that we investigate all potential crimes brought to our attention, adding that if it was brought to our attention, we would certainly review any potential crime to see if it is indeed a crime or an administrative violation. It would also be a violation of Florida tax laws, potentially. So they're looking at that down in the state of Florida. Wouldn't it be fun? Wouldn't it be interesting if the top campaign official on the Donald Trump campaign was charged with voter fraud? It would be fun and also not surprising at all to those of us who have been following this mess. Finally, last story. Vladimir Putin has been arrested at a Florida supermarket.
What?
Yes, really. Police, speaking of Florida, police down in West Palm Beach, Florida, say that a 48-year-old man who shares the name of the Russian president was arrested at a public supermarket in the city's downtown last week. Police say Putin was screaming at employees and refused to leave the store. Records with the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, according to AP, show that he was charged with trespassing and resisting an officer without violence. Putin appeared in court on Monday and was released on his own recognizance.
See, you'd never get to say that about any other world leader, probably.
Maybe. We'll see how things go. My thanks to could be a busy year. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Jeremy Nichols of Wild Earth Guardians, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's greatly appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, go listen to that fun Paul LePage show from yesterday. You can download it for free at bradblog.com. You can also reach me via email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. See you there. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.